When people think of Chicago, many likely picture the tall buildings that create our amazing skyline or tourist destinations like Navy Pier or shopping on the Magnificent Mile. Their minds may also go to images of our amazing museums or sports venues like Sox Park or Soldier Field. But what about Chicago's parks? Today, with the help of this episode's co-writer and co-host, Connie Fairbanks, we're going to highlight five Chicago parks named in honor of notable women from Chicago's past. I'm Tommy Henry.
And I'm Connie Fairbanks, and this is the Chicago History Podcast.
Some of you should remember Connie from an episode we did a while back about her book, Chicago's West Loop, Then and Now, People, Businesses, and Buildings. If you haven't read it, there is a link in the show's notes as to where you can buy Connie's book. As we learned during the pandemic, neighborhood parks play a significant role in the well-being of residents of big cities, especially those in high-rises, for outside space to move around and for socialization. They also provide hubs for neighborhoods to participate in rich cultural activities, offer a way to meet neighbors, and learn about Chicago history.
Chicago's commitment to parks and green spaces is reflected in its official motto, Urbs in Horto, which translated from Latin means city in a garden. While numerous early plans for more green spaces may not have come to fruition, the Chicago Park District still manages 570 parks that cover more than 7,600 acres of land throughout the city.
According to the Trust for Public Land, 10% of Chicago's land is used for parks and recreation, and while that is 5% lower than the national median, 98% of Chicago residents live within a 10-minute walk of a park. Many parks have obvious names, Lincoln Park, Grant Park, etc., but there are many others with names that aren't as obvious and some that often aren't even pronounced correctly. That is certainly the case with the first park we're discussing today.
In the West Loop, in an area bounded by Monroe, Adams, Peoria, and Sagamon Streets, is Bartlemé Park. If you're wondering how that is spelled, B-A-R-T-E-L-M-E, Bartlemé. This 2.71-acre park features elements combining a sense of history with modern, innovative design. Three diagonal paths intersect in this park to create distinct zones. These zones include a children's play area, a fountain plaza, an open lawn area, a sunken dog park, a viewing hill, and enclosed seating area. Mary Margaret Bartlemé was born in Chicago in 1866 to German immigrants and lived at Halstead and Fulton. She grew up with five siblings, pulling taffy, quilting, and singing French songs. Miss Bartlemé attended high school at the old West Division High School at Monroe and South Morgan Streets. She went on to study at Cook County Normal School, a teacher's college now known as Chicago State University. Bartlemé taught in Chicago's public elementary schools before earning a law degree at Northwestern University. In 1897, Bartlemé became the first woman appointed Cook County Public Guardian in Illinois, where she served 17 years under four governors. Mary Bartlemé was the first woman asked to address the Illinois Bar Association in 1911. While she was bright, well-educated, and loved a challenge, these types of responsibilities were uncommon for women at this time.
Throughout her life, Ms. Bartlemé always strived to make lives better in Chicago, especially for young women. She formed three Mary Clubs for girls who couldn't return to their parents. The first two, formed in 1914 and 1916, accepted white girls. The third, started in 1921, was for girls of color. In roughly 10 years, more than 2,600 girls passed through these group homes.
Bartlemé believed that every young woman in foster care was entitled to proper clothes and accessories. She earned the nickname of Suitcase Mary because she led fundraising drives to buy suitcases and fill them with clothes for poverty-stricken girls. Bartlemé always kept donated clothes in her law office for children in need. In 1991's Chicago Portraits by June Skinner Sawyers, the writer includes the following Bartlemé quote: "There are no bad children. There are confused, neglected children, love-starved, and resentful children. And what they need most, I try to give them, understanding and a fresh start in the right direction."
Bartlemé and her friend Jane Addams, Chicago's pioneer of social work, believed that truancy was not always a sign of delinquency in young girls, and that hunger from a lack of food at home is often the cause. In 1923, a mere 3 years after women won the right to vote, Mary Bartlemé was elected judge of the Circuit Court, the first female judge in Illinois history and the second in the nation. During that time, Bartlemé also advocated for full citizenship rights for women. She served as judge of the Circuit Court until her retirement in 1933. At the time, the Chicago Tribune described Mary Bartlemé as very normal, easy to understand, but hard to analyze. Judge Mary Bartlemé died in 1954, tending to her garden in Carmel, California.
One of Bartlemé's greatest legacies is Chicago's beautiful Mary Bartlemé Park, named for her in 2010. Bartlemé Park is used daily by hundreds of children, parents, and other visitors. The park is modern, innovative, and sustainable, and has anchored the West Loop as a place where people want to live, work, and play. At the northwest edge of Mary Bartlemé Park is a plaque that commemorates Judge Bartlemé's significant accomplishments. Many Chicagoans helped bring the longtime vision of Mary Bartlemé Park to fruition. They include former Alderman Fioretti, Leslie Reck, the Trust for Public Land, Annie Costner, and many others. Armando Chacon, longtime resident of the West Loop and a former president of the Mary Bartlemé Park Advisory Council, calls it the Piazza of the West Loop. And a fun fact, Bartlemé Park is on the former site of the Illinois Charitable Eye and Ear Infirmary, which existed there from 1874 to 1965.
At 44th and St. Lawrence Avenue in the Grand Boulevard community area, visitors can find Armstrong Park, specifically the Lillian Hardin Armstrong Park. At a little more than 9 acres, this park has baseball diamonds, basketball courts, a pebble track around the perimeter, and a mini library for those with a love of reading. Lillian Beatrice Dempsey, known as Lil, was born in Memphis in 1898 close to the Beale Street Entertainment area. Doted on by her mother, Lillian became obsessed with the musical sounds she heard in her neighborhood every day. Young Lillian began organ lessons at the age of 6, quickly learning how to read music. Soon Lil could play by ear. Lil's mother was so impressed by the promise Lil showed in her musical pursuits that she took on extra work to help pay for Lil's after-school music lessons. Lil's mother was extremely protective of her daughter and wanted her to have a better life than her family had growing up in the time of slavery. Lil's mother enrolled Lil in college in 1915 at Fisk University, a historically black university, where she received more musical training. Lil's mother, ever watchful over her daughter, began to believe that Memphis, a city that bluesman Sleepy John Estes once called the center of all evil in the known universe, was not the place to raise her daughter. Not long after, when Lillian was 19, she and her mother moved to the south side of Chicago in 1918.
Arriving in Chicago, Lillian's obsession with music continued. Talented and beautiful, she found work playing sheet music on piano in the front window of Jones Music Store at 34th and South State Street. There she built relationships that led her to better paying gigs at local clubs. At the time, bands didn't need a piano player, but because the piano was considered a white instrument, and many groups wouldn't risk bringing on a woman player. Lillian convinced them differently and never had any issues with the male band members she worked with for many years. Later, she faced resistance from ballroom managers and promoters when she was negotiating contracts and asking for top dollar.
King Oliver of King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band took a risk and hired Lillian in 1918. According to James L. Dickerson, author of Just for the Thrill, Lil Hardin Armstrong, First Lady of Jazz, this band was the hottest jazz band in Chicago and probably in the U.S. Lillian was known as Hot Miss Lil because she played like a man but dressed like a Sunday school teacher. Lillian was known as the brain of her bands, not just the soul. She had a perfect ear for music, she could read music, and she was surprised that her fellow band members couldn't. Lil knew how to stay in the middle of the keyboard and was more interested in rhythm than virtuosity. Lillian was determined to not only be a professional performer, but also a role model for how to live as a musician and entertainer. She did not want to succumb to the indulgences of many jazz musicians of the day. To help keep her out of trouble, Lillian's mother would meet her at 1 a.m. after her two nightclub shows to make sure Lil got home safely. While playing at Dreamland Cafe at 35th and State Street in Chicago's Bronzeville neighborhood, Lillian fell in love with a fellow musician named Jimmy Johnson. Sadly, their marriage was short-lived.
Lillian met her musical soulmate and second husband, trumpet player Louis Armstrong, while playing the piano in the Creole Jazz Band. Lillian and Louis married in 1924 when she was 26 and Louis was 22. They purchased a home together and lived at 421 East 44th Street in Chicago. Eventually, both of their beloved mothers moved in with them. Lil and Louis played their brand of jazz music in some of the top clubs of Chicago. Reportedly, Al Capone enjoyed listening to them. Lillian taught Louis Armstrong how to read music, encouraged him to lose 50 pounds, wear nicer clothing, was his manager, and helped him sign lucrative deals as the star, not just the backup trumpeter. Lillian saw something in Louis that he didn't see in himself. In late 1925, Lillian helped create a billboard in Chicago that read, "Louis Armstrong, the world's greatest trumpet player." With her marketing savvy, she convinced Armstrong to own that spot in jazz history. During their marriage, they recorded some of the first jazz albums made in the U.S. with Jennet and the Star Piano Company and OK Records. While their ability to make music was successful, their marriage was unable to survive Louis' many affairs and addictions. They divorced in 1942.
Throughout her life, Lillian dedicated herself to her talents by finishing two advanced musical degrees at the Chicago College of Music in 1928 and the New York College of Music. She purchased a second home in Michigan, bought a second-hand Hudson car that some described as being about a block long, learned French, taught school, opened a soul food restaurant, staged a fashion show in New York City during World War II, and designed much of Louis Armstrong's wardrobe. Lillian also did some recording for a French record label and considered self-publishing her own autobiography, but decided to wait as she felt there were stories included that might be hurtful to Louis. Although some of Lillian's ventures failed, she kept going, always hearing her mother's voice in the background, encouraging her to be a role model for Black Americans. Throughout Lillian Armstrong's life, as a prolific songwriter, she composed over 150 songs and started many bands, including all-female bands.
Lillian attended Louis Armstrong's funeral in Queens, New York in 1971. She was able to keep his treasured trumpet for herself. Although divorced for nearly 30 years, Lillian was reportedly heartbroken at the loss of Louis. Lillian returned to Chicago, and within 7 weeks, she agreed to be part of a musical tribute to Louis Armstrong. While playing the last chord of St. Louis Blues by W.C. Hardy, Lillian toppled over at the keyboard, passing away on the way to the hospital. According to her friends, Lillian Armstrong died of a broken heart at the age of 73. Lillian Harden Armstrong, First Lady of Jazz, a music visionary, and the second wife of Louis Armstrong, was interred at Lincoln Cemetery in Blue Island, Illinois. Armstrong Park was named for Lillian Harden Armstrong in 2004.
At 56 and South Indiana Avenue in Chicago's Woodlawn area, guests can find Hansberry Park. During the Depression and World War II, the population of Chicago's Southside Washington Park community increased by 29%. Realizing the need for additional recreational space for the growing community, in the mid-1950s, the city purchased a quarter-acre property, installing playground equipment and basketball courts, referring to it as Indiana and 56th Park. It wouldn't get its current name until 2004. Lorraine Vivian Hansberry was born in 1930 at Provident Hospital, the youngest of four children born to Carl Hansberry, a successful real estate developer, and Nanny, a teacher and ward committee woman. When Lorraine was almost 8 years old, her father bought a house at 6140 South Rhodes Avenue in the Washington Park area on the city's south side, angering many of the white neighbors who had signed a covenant that did not allow homes to be sold to blacks. After moving into the home, a brick crashed through a window, narrowly missing young Lorraine. The family was forced to move. Instead of bowing to efforts by the racist area homeowners, Carl Hansberry filed a lawsuit challenging racially restrictive covenants that made it all the way to the Supreme Court. Although it took 3 years, he eventually prevailed.
Lorraine Hansberry excelled in school, graduating from Chicago's Inglewood High School. Hansberry attended the University of Wisconsin at Madison, where she successfully integrated a dormitory. And then she moved to New York City in 1950, where she became a professional writer and became involved in activist struggles. Those early memories of the Hansberry family trying to buy a home in a white area remained with Lorraine, influencing Hansberry's 1959 play, A Raisin in the Sun, a semi-autobiographical story of her family's ordeal. A Raisin in the Sun was the first play to be written by a Black American and the first Black American play to be produced on Broadway. Mildred Marie Langford, who played the character of Benita in Raisin in the Sun at Chicago's Timeline Theater in 2013, said, "Benita was a woman determined to defy the confines of her space and time. despite the oppressive limitations placed on women and Black people at the time. She is one of the great roles of American theater.
Ms. Hansberry was an activist for many causes, as quoted in the Legacy Project Chicago, quote, Hansberry linked the struggle for gay rights, rights for people of color, and rights for women. Never one to shy away from challenges, in 1963, Hansberry pleaded with Attorney General Robert Kennedy to make a moral commitment on civil rights. Sadly, Hansberry died of pancreatic cancer in 1965 at the young age of 34.
Lorraine Hansberry's legacy lives on, including at Chicago's Court Theater in Hyde Park, where in the spring of 2025, a new production of her most beloved play, A Raisin in the Sun, will stage for the very first time. In 2004, the park at 5635 South Indiana was renamed Lorraine Hansberry Park in honor of one of Chicago's most successful playwrights and activists. Lorraine Hansberry Park sits on about 1 acre at 56th and Indiana in the Woodlawn neighborhood. Of note, during her high school years, Lorraine lived at 5936 South Parkway, now Dr. Martin Luther King Drive, approximately 1/2 mile from her namesake park at Indiana Avenue and 56th.
Formerly known as Park 570, Donahue Park in the city's Lakeview area just north of School Street and west of Racine isn't the biggest park in Chicago. It's slightly larger than a half acre, but it does honor the first female executive in baseball history, Margaret Donahue. Born in 1892, Margaret Midge Donahue was the second born child in a family of eight in Huntley, Illinois, then a rural farming community roughly 57 miles northwest of downtown Chicago. After attending 1 year of high school and 1 year of secretarial school, Donahue went to work for a laundry facility, a position that she soon lost to a returning World War I veteran. Donahue soon found a stenographer job by placing the advertisement in the Situations Wanted column in the newspaper. One thing she forgot to include in her classified ad was that she preferred to work in the loop.
Bill Veeck Sr., the president of the Chicago Cubs baseball organization in 1919, saw Margaret's ad and called her while she was at church. Margaret's father answered the phone, assuring Veeck that his daughter would be at the interview. While Margaret Donahue initially turned down the job with the Cubs because she preferred to work in the loop, not miles north in Lakeview, Veeck was very persistent and convinced Margaret to work for the Cubs. Soon, Aunt Midge, as fans began to call her, was the team's bookkeeper, handling season tickets, press passes, cash receipts, and transfers for the Cubs and all other Wrigley Field events. Impressed by Donahue's smarts and work ethic, Veeck promoted Donahue to corporate secretary for the Cubs in 1926, after just 7 years with the organization. According to the 2012 book, Bill Veeck, Baseball's Greatest Maverick by Paul Dixon, during a meeting in New York, Veeck announced, I haven't signed any players recently, but I'll tell you what I have done that means much to our club. I have, or rather our board of directors, has elected a new club secretary, a woman, the only woman secretary in organized ball. Her name is Miss Margaret Donahue. We feel that in Miss Donahue, we have added a real asset to our club organization.
Being a female executive in Major League Baseball was unheard of at the time, and the story of her new role made national news. Donahue's promotion was featured on the front page of the Chicago Tribune's December 14, 1926 sports section, where she was pictured sitting behind her desk, and the Sporting News even covered the story. Donahue worked 7 days a week and allegedly never took a vacation. She traveled with the Cubs baseball team to away games. As respect for Donahue was strong, there was never an issue for her as the only woman in the room. Margaret Donahue's contributions to the Cubs organization, later adopted by other baseball organizations, were many. Donahue is credited with selling season tickets prior to the 1929 season, which was a huge success. Fun fact, the first two season ticket buyers were women. Vec Sr. announced at the end of February of that year that demand for tickets had broken all Cubs records, with thousands of tickets sold more than a month before the season was due to begin. "It's the greatest preseason rush in Cubs history," Vec said. Margaret Donahue came up with promotion ideas such as offering discounted tickets to kids under 12, established a popular Ladies' Day, and convinced Cubs management to allow tickets to be sold off-site at Western Union locations. Aunt Midge felt baseball should have a family atmosphere, and her motto, "make sure Cubs fans leave the ballpark happy," set the tone for the team's approach.
After Bill Vec Sr. died in 1933, Cubs owner William Wrigley made some horrible management hires. And yet, Margaret Donahue stayed on, retiring in 1958 after 39 years with the organization. When she retired, Aunt Midge shared the following about the Cubs' poor strategy in developing players with the Chicago Sun-Times. "I believe we fell behind the parade because we didn't go into the farm business soon enough," Donahue said. "Late in the 30s, when others were developing their players, we were still trying to buy them. And we also refused to pay bonuses until recently." After Donahue's retirement, Cubs owner Philip K. Wrigley issued a proclamation on behalf of the Cubs Board of Directors stating that Donahue was a nationally acknowledged authority on the intricacies of baseball rules and regulations. In honor of her long and meritorious service with the Chicago Cubs, Donahue was even given a golden pass, signed by Major League Baseball's top brass in 1958, which offered her free lifetime access to any game in any major league stadium.
Margaret Donahue moved back to Huntley, Illinois, where she died in 1978. On the night of her funeral, she was eulogized on Chicago's WGN radio by Jack Brickhouse, whom she had welcomed to Chicago at the start of his long broadcasting career. Sports Illustrated announced Donahue's death in its February 13, 1978 issue. Donahue is buried in St. Mary's Cemetery in Huntley. For locals, the farm where Margaret Donahue was born and raised is now home to Huntley's Walmart at Kreutzer Road and Route 47 as of this writing. Fortunately, Margaret Donahue's legacy lives on at Donahue Park. The 21,000 square foot School Street play lot at 1230 West School Street, slightly more than a half mile from her home away from home, Wrigley Field, was named in her honor in 2014. Converted from abandoned industrial and warehouse use, the Margaret Donahue Park was funded by a $1 million donation from the Cubs organization and from community and private donations. The park has a playground, rubberized soft surfacing, spray features for hot summer days, meets ADA guidelines, and is often full of kids and families. At just 0.32 acres, this is the smallest park we're covering today, but the Lucy Parsons Park at the intersection of Belmont and Kilpatrick in the Belmont-Cragen neighborhood is delightful. Although small, the park features a soft surface, ADA-accessible play area, with all the swings and slides kids need to burn off a little energy. There's also a water spray area for those hot Chicago days and shaded community tables. So, Who was Lucy Parsons?
Lucy Ella Gonzalez Parsons' early life is a little hazy, but most historians agree she was born into slavery around 1851, likely in Virginia, before being brought to Texas. For much of her life, Parsons created ambiguity regarding her race. She preferred that people speculate about her origins, says Jacqueline Jones, professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin and author of 2017's Goddess of Anarchy, The Life and Times of Lucy Parsons, American Radical. She at one point claimed that she had been born to a Mexican parent and then a Native American parent. She would get them mixed up, which was which, because this was all a fabrication. After the Emancipation Proclamation freed her, Lucia Carter, as she was known then, began living with an older man who paid for her education at a local school for Black students.
Lucy met the person she would most be associated with for the rest of her life, Albert Parsons, in Waco, Texas. It is unclear whether Parsons, a white newspaper editor and former Confederate soldier, was able to marry Lucy as interracial marriage was still illegal in most parts of the U.S., but they treated each other as husband and wife for the rest of their time together. Around 1873, Lucy and Albert moved to Chicago, settling in a community of German immigrants. They quickly became involved in the socialist labor movement of the time. With his strong oratory skills, Albert Parsons became a prominent face of the labor movement, while Lucy Parsons worked behind the scenes on strategy. On May 4th, 1886, after numerous protests and strikes to demand an 8-hour workday, an unidentified person at Haymarket Square threw a bomb at a crowd at police, resulting in a riot and the deaths of 7 police officers and at least 4 civilians. Although Albert and Lucy Parsons were one half block north at a bar called Zepp's Hall at the corner of Lake and Des Plaines when the bombing occurred, Albert Parsons, who had spoken to a peaceful crowd at Haymarket Square earlier that day, was one of the men accused of the crime.
Albert Parsons was prosecuted, convicted, and executed for the Haymarket affair. While Lucy Parsons had started publicly advocating on behalf of her husband during his trial, she became an even more prominent figure in the labor movement after his death. Lucy Parsons would go on to become one of the most recognized voices concerning labor struggles and a founder of the Industrial Workers of the World.
At the time of her death in 1942, at around the age of 91, Lucy Parsons lived at 3130 North Troy, since demolished for the Northwest Expressway, now called the Kennedy. But her home was only slightly more than a mile from the park site that has carried Parsons' name since 2004. I do hope you've enjoyed today's episode about Chicago's parks named for prominent women. Special thanks to my co-writer and co-host Connie Fairbanks for doing much of the heavy lifting to make this episode come together. Do you have a local park about which you'd like to know more? Send me an email at chicagohistorypod@gmail.com. If we cover it in a future episode, we'll give you credit for suggesting it. For more pictures and info related to the parks covered today, follow Chicago History Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads. If you enjoy the podcast, please leave a 5-star rating or, even better, a written review, especially if you listen on Apple Podcasts, as it will help the podcast grow and reach new fans. Your review may be featured on a future episode or on social media. The Chicago History Podcast logo and the art used on the social media pages was created by John K. Schneider, Aces Johnny. He can be found at Angel Eyes Art JKS on Instagram or via email at angeleyesartjks@gmail.com. We'll be back next week with another chapter in Chicago's history. Until then, get out and explore when possible. Go out and enjoy a local park. Learn more about whatever city you live in. Stay safe.